Okay, welcome back to part two of what I have to say this morning. So I'm going to talk about a very different project that has some similar aspects, but the end result, I hope you'll agree, is very different. I became aware some years ago of observations made by, often by clinicians, that blood samples, serum, from patients with metastatic cancer are filled with small vesicles that, that cells secrete that contain certain small RNA molecules. And I had a graduate student join the group, a fellow by the name of Matt Chertloff, who had, as a technician, worked in a clinical lab at, in Portland, Oregon, where they studied these so-called exosomes. And he was sufficiently interested to pursue this, and I decided at my advanced age I can afford to do something different. And so we have, for the last 3 years, looked at these extracellular vesicles, exosomes, how they are, to some extent, how they are made, and specifically what kinds of small RNAs they have and how they are sorted during the formation of these extracellular vesicles. Now, the vesicles are not there just to promote metastatic cancer. They're produced by normal cells. They're found in the serum of normal people. They're found indeed in many metazoans, probably not in yeast, but maybe in other microorganisms. And they are believed, and there is some evidence, that they may serve as kind of complex signaling machines that can convey even membrane proteins, normal membrane proteins, normal membrane receptors. Hedgehog, for instance, may be conveyed by this kind of a mechanism where it's packaged into a vesicle and delivered to a target cell. Along the way, RNAs became enclosed within these vesicles at some point, and that may have been exploited to transfer information and possible regulators of gene expression. And so there is some evidence that exosomes can change target cells, the morphology and metabolism of target cells. There is some very limited evidence that the nucleic acids conveyed in exosomes can alter gene expression in target cells. But it's really, I have to say, the standards in this field, this cottage industry of exosome biology, are really poor, really poor. And I'll tell in the next few minutes, I'll tell you why this has happened and what we're trying to do about it. But let me just summarize a little bit about what's known. So the exosomes are extracellular vesicles, typical bilayer vesicles. They have certain membrane proteins that are enriched in them. I'll talk about one that we use as a marker for these exosomes to purify them. There are some cytoplasmic proteins that seem to be enriched in the luminal interior of the vesicle. And as I've indicated, they have a set of small RNAs, generally very small, on the range of around 100 nucleotides. Transfer RNAs are chemically the most abundant RNA species in exosomes. What the transfer RNAs are doing there is totally obscure.
50 nanometer-ish.
The vesicles are a little bigger, although here's the problem. One of the basic problems in the field is when clinicians have isolated these things, they take either serum or they take cultured tumor cell lines. They sediment at low speed to get rid of cells. They take the supernatant fraction and they sediment at 100,000 times G, and they call the pellet fraction from that exosomes. And if you just look at the material, it's very heterogeneous. There's some big membranes, there's some little membranes, and very few people have explored this from a basic mechanistic perspective. And so, as you'll see, we wanted to purify a particular species. And if you look at the literature, there are very few examples where people bothered to purify an individual species. So the composition is really, I don't believe much of what is reported in their composition, and I won't until people purify these things. Okay, so there's something a little known about their biogenesis, although it's not entirely convincing. There is some evidence that these things arise by a pathway that you may have heard of in other lectures, a pathway where proteins are internalized by invaginations into the interior of a membrane, an endosome, which gives rise to a structure called the multivesicular body. Have you heard about this in other lectures, the MVB?
Yes.
Yeah?
We heard it. Yeah, I talked about MVBs.
You talked about MVBs. Okay, good. All right. Well, MVBs have been invoked for the turnover of cell surface receptors that are internalized, delivered, and typically cell surface receptors that are ubiquitinated are internalized and are diverted by a machinery called the escort machinery into these invaginations, and vesicles then are delivered and ultimately degraded in the lysosome, and the cell surface receptors then can be irreversibly turned over. But at some point, and for by a mechanism that is totally obscure, some of these MVBs actually fuse at the cell surface, and there, in doing so, they deliver a bolus of these what were intraluminal vesicles to the cell exterior, and they give rise to these extracellular vesicles or exosomes. But it is also formally possible, not shown on this image, that some population of extracellular vesicles arise by budding directly from the plasma membrane. Topologically, this would be equivalent to the secretion of exosomes. That is, the luminal content of the vesicle represents molecules from the cytoplasm, whether they're formed by this path or by budding from the cell surface. And we know of examples of budding from the cell surface. Enveloped RNA envelope viruses like HIV bud from the cell surface. And they use, in fact, elements of the escort machinery required for the biogenesis of MVBs to bud from the cell surface. So some fraction of exosomes almost certainly arise directly from the cell surface, but this has not been explored. So Matt, when he joined the lab, we decided to focus on trying, in the first instance, to purify a discrete set of vesicles produced by a cell line, HEK293 cells that we use in the lab, it's a convenient cell line because we can control gene expression by RNAi, by siRNA, or by CRISPR-Cas9. There's nothing special about this cell line, but we saw that they produce extracellular vesicles. We saw that the extracellular vesicles contain a particular membrane protein called CD63, a four-spanning or tetraspanin membrane protein that is synthesized and found in endosomes and is often displayed at the cell surface. And it seems to be enriched in crude exosomes. So we devised a fractionation scheme following the distribution of this protein through a series of steps. First, by low-speed sedimentation to remove large membranes, smaller vesicles were collected at 100,000 times G. We didn't believe that these were at all pure, so we then subjected this crude high-speed pellet fraction to buoyant density sedimentation on a sucrose step gradient, and found by immunoblot analysis that CD63 enriched species equilibrated at the interface between 20% and 40% sucrose, whereas other membranes from this pellet fraction distributed elsewhere on the gradient. We were still not convinced that this material was pure, so we had an antibody, a commercial antibody, against an extracellular loop of CD63 that we could immobilize and use to affinity purify vesicles from this interface fraction. And that this material can be eluted with the peptide against which the antibody was raised. And then at that point, we had a fraction that we thought was pretty clean. Maybe not pure, but pretty clean. Yes? So it's a membrane protein, is made in the secretory pathway. It's diverted to the endosome, but it also appears at the cell surface. It's in various locations. Its function is sort of not relevant to this discussion, but it may be involved in cell-cell interactions. Yes? Just because they're abundant.
So the mirror, or the microRNA, the small RNAs that they found in patient samples, were those mirrors or small RNAs upregulated?
Well, bear with me for a few minutes, and you'll see that it is not just a passive capture of any old small RNA. You'll see that a very selective sorting of RNAs, or selective stabilization of a set of RNAs, at least in the vesicles that we purified. And so that raises the mechanistic question that we focused on. But thanks for that prompt. Yes?
There seems to be an assumption here that the exosomes that are going to be interesting have CD63.
No, it was just we wanted a specific molecular reporter that would allow us to focus our attention on that species.
Subset,
maybe, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there could be
other. Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, I have another new graduate student who's taken the same density gradient, resolved it a little, you know, to display things a little more evenly on a sucrose density gradient, and has found a species of a different buoyant density that's marked by a different membrane protein. And so we're trying to purify that vesicle and see what it contains. No, this was reported in the literature. In crude exosome fractions, CD63 is an abundant membrane protein. And so we simply said, well, let's see if there's a particular subfraction of vesicles that contain CD63. Okay. So we did this, but we wanted another technique that would allow us to quantify the fractionation of CD63. And you'll see this is useful in another context. So what we did was we fused the gene for CD63 to luciferase, a very potent enzyme that can be easily detected, has a huge turnover number in it, so we can easily assess how CD63 luciferase fractionates, and we can actually then use the presence of luciferase to map the topology of this fusion protein in isolated exosomes. So here is a quantification of the fractionation of the CD63 luciferase reporter during the various steps that I showed you in the previous slide. There is a progressive enrichment in the specific activity of luciferase from the high-speed pellet fraction to the sucrose interface to the peptide-eluted immuno-isolated vesicles. Correspondingly, Matt showed that the material bound to CD63 antibody contained RNA. It's just total RNA, whereas a control irrelevant antibody, which didn't bind CD63, there was no detectable RNA. So there's clearly some RNA that's really in these vesicles that marked by CD63. Now, we also knew, because of the known topology of CD63, we predicted that luciferase, if fused to the C-terminus, would be in the interior, internal to the exosome. But we could show that by a really simple latency measurement biochemically. The luciferase enzyme activity depends on two substrates, one of which is impermeable, ATP. And so if you take the vesicles and you mix them with substrates, ATP and luciferin, you wouldn't expect to actually be able to measure luciferase unless the membrane were permeabilized. Indeed, the enzyme activity is latent unless you add detergent. The enzyme activity is also exquisitely sensitive to proteolysis in the presence of detergent, and this actually will become important in a moment. So this confirmed the predicted topology and orientation of the protein within these vesicles. So with this highly purified material, we then asked a very important question, which you alluded to, and that is there some selectivity in the capture of RNA? So we did the first of now many deep sequence RNA analyses, and first focusing on the distribution of microRNAs in these vesicles compared to the cells from which the exosomes arise. And most of the roughly 600 different microRNAs that we detected in this deep-seq analysis were found either in the cells alone or mostly in cells and exosomes. But interestingly, a set of 56 were highly enriched in exosomes, some of which so highly enriched, such as this one, miR-223, that this one was barely detected in the cells from which the exosomes arise, 1,000-fold enriched in the course of these exosomes being produced and exported from cells. There are many things to ways to interpret that. One is that there is an active RNA sorting event that goes on, that for some reason these cells are producing exosomes, packaging certain microRNAs. There are two reasons why that may happen. One is these microRNAs may have some function in a target cell, so they have to be the exosomes may have to be delivered. There is evidence that exosomes can be taken up by target cells. It's still possible that microRNAs serve in some role, regulatory role. The other way that you could easily think about this is that this is a way that cells have just quickly getting rid of microRNAs that it wants to get rid of, just expel them. We can't distinguish those two models just now. But we can ask a basic question about how the RNA is sorted. To my mind, that implies that there's some sequence or structure in the RNA that's recognized, and there's some machinery to decode that, to affect the sorting. And so we wanted to explore that mechanism, and we thought that by exploring the mechanism, understanding, again, biochemically how this works, we might then gain some insight into why the cell bothers to do this. That's really the ultimate goal, is to figure out why the hell the cell does this. Okay, so then just for completeness, we repeated the fractionation scheme and showed that two different highly enriched microRNAs, this one that I already told you about, miR-223, another one, miR-144, really are progressively enriched in vesicles as they are fractionated by the scheme I showed you a moment ago. Both of them very highly enriched. And we could use the susceptibility of these RNAs to ribonuclease to show that they are really nicely contained in the interior of the exosome. So again, these two microRNAs are perfectly resistant to ribonuclease unless the membranes are permeabilized with detergent. So just like luciferase, these things are inside. So now the question is, how do they get there? Okay, so as we always do in my lab over many years, the way we try to solve a problem is to tease it apart using biochemistry, to break the cells open and try to reproduce a significant aspect of this mechanism with isolated membranes and ultimately with purified soluble proteins. And Matt was up to the challenge. And so we cooked up two different approaches to ask biochemically how microRNAs are acquired by these vesicles. The first is, I'll refer to it as a biogenesis assay. And basically what this assay allowed us to do was to measure the formation with isolated membranes of, we believe, vesicles into which luciferase is sequestered to be latent. Let me describe how the assay works. We rupture cells by mechanical means. We take these cells, HEK-293, and we simply pass them through a narrow gauge needle repeatedly until the membranes are broken. We imagine in the lysate, at the moment of rupture, if exosomes arise from endosomes, that there will be some CD63 luciferase molecules that have already been packaged into intraluminal vesicles. And the prediction is that the luciferase will be separated from the buffer in which the membranes are suspended by two membranes. So if the buffer includes luciferin and ATP, this luciferase sequestered in the intraluminal vesicles will be inaccessible and will not hydrolyze and will not, in this case, release the product, which actually is photons. You measure luciferase by measuring the production of light. Really sensitive assay. Probably the majority of the CD63 luciferase will be still on the surface of the membrane where luciferase would be accessible to substrate and would hydrolyze ATP and luciferin to make photons. Some of the molecules may be primed and just right, you know, at the poised at the moment of entry into an invagination. And we thought that if these membranes were suspended in cytosol, we presume cytosolic proteins were responsible for some of these biogenesis events, in the presence of ATP and luciferin, and then an incubation at a physiologic temperature were conducted over the period, in this case, of just 20 minutes, that perhaps in the course of this incubation, some new vesicles would form that would swallow up substrates into the interior where photons would continue to be produced. And now, crucially, these molecules, plus the previous ones, which don't have substrate, would be inaccessible to trypsin added after the 20-minute incubation. So we do the incubation, we centrifuge the membranes, we resuspend gently and now just in buffer on ice in the presence of trypsin under conditions where the luciferase that remained on the surface of the membrane, or indeed in any other membranes present in this crude extract, would be readily degraded and thus inactive and not available to hydrolyze substrate. This reaction would then be transferred to a tube in a luminometer, and the continued production of photons, we predicted, would measure those vesicles that had been internalized during the 20-minute incubation at 30 degrees. That was our imagination. And of course, I wouldn't tell you this, except that it seemed to work. And so here is one such experiment. Just let me show these results, and then we can talk about them. So here's an incubation of where membranes are mixed with cytosol. The incubation was conducted at 30 degrees for 20 minutes in the presence of substrates. The membranes were centrifuged, treated with trypsin, then put in the luminometer to measure the production of photons. It was a small signal, but readily detected, and we set it just to 100% for control purposes and compared that to other incubations conducted, for example, in the absence of cytosol, but in the presence of membranes and substrates. A very much lower signal was developed. In the presence of detergent to dissolve all the membranes, a very low signal. Or in a control incubation where the entire complete sample was simply held on ice for the same length of time. Typically, these kinds of biogenesis reactions require a physiologic temperature incubation. So a very low signal here. So this gave us some confidence that we were maybe measuring something relevant. Now, what's your question? No, this is an endosome. I mean, the idea was in the crude extract, there will be endosomes. We made the conditions of lysis were gentle enough so that the endosomes would themselves not be ruptured. And the hope was that these endosomes would still be biogenically competent. Now, if you want to play the devil's advocate, since we didn't really know that endosomes were involved in this particular biogenesis event, it was alternatively conceivable that what we'd be measuring was budding from a piece of plasma membrane. But if you think about it, the same principle applies if we happen to be measuring budding from the plasma membrane. You would predict that you'd form a vesicle budding from the plasma membrane into which substrates and luciferase would become enclosed, would be resistant to exogenous trypsin, and all the other luciferase that happened to be anywhere else would be degraded. So this was neutral. What I really loved about this, the idea was completely neutral about where this biogenesis reaction originates. But we'll discuss that more later. Okay, so this preliminary experiment repeated. It was looking promising. And so Matt decided to launch right into using the same reaction to try to measure the packaging of microRNAs. And that was a really, in principle, an even simpler idea. The same incubation. In this case, we used chemically synthetic miR-223, that species that is a thousandfold enriched, and cytosol from HEK-293 cells, where the endogenous cytosolic level of miR-223 is very low, barely detected. So we added a chemical excess of synthetic miR-223 to this incubation, including ATP, which is often involved in these kinds of biogenesis reactions. The reaction proceeded. Membranes were centrifuged, and in this case, treated with ribonuclease to degrade any unincorporated RNA in the incubation. The membranes were centrifuged. After that RNA's treatment, the membranes dissolved, and RNA extracted, amplified, and then quantified by qT-PCR. And we asked, can we detect the packaging of sequestered miR-223? And it worked surprisingly well for these kinds of incubations in a crude extract. At 30 degrees, in the presence of membranes, And cytosol and chemically synthetic miR-223, in the first initial results, about 7% of the exogenous miR-223 is present and resistant to ribonuclease. The signal is much lower if the incubation is conducted on ice. It is even lower if cytosol is omitted from the incubation. It is also very low if membranes are omitted from the incubation. And it is very low if detergent is present throughout the incubation. So this suggested to us that there was some uptake of this RNA into a detergent-sensitive, presumably, membrane dependent upon the membranes and cytosol from these cells. We investigated the role of ATP, hydrolyzable ATP, in this reaction. It is stimulated, but at least in our crude reaction, not absolutely dependent on hydrolysis of ATP, about a twofold stimulation in the reaction on either omission of ATP, on hydrolysis of ATP by an enzyme, a pyrase, or on addition of a non-hydrolyzable analog of ATP, the signal declines about twofold. Still measurably above that seen in a control incubation conducted on ice. Okay, now, the crucial question, if this has any meaning, is can we observe a species-selective packaging of RNA? In other words, is this a faithful reproduction of the selectivity that we observed when we measured the RNA content of purified exosomes? And so that was a simple experiment. Matt made chemically synthetic miR-190, which is a species found exclusively in the cytoplasm of HEK-293 cells, and conducted a parallel incubation. In this incubation, he's getting better at it. We're nearly 10% efficient packaging of miR-223 at 30 degrees, much lower at 4 degrees, and a low, but still measurable, but very low level of miR-190 packaging compared to a 4-degree control. If you measure crudely the kinetics of these reactions, the rate at which miR-223 is packaged mirrors the rate at which luciferase forms a latent species in the biogenesis reaction, whereas the rate of what would be maybe non-selective packaging of miR-190 mirrors the rate at which luciferase becomes latent in a control incubation held on ice. Yes, Wallace. No. No. That's an interesting question, but of course, remember the cytosol is crude cytosol, so there's plenty of RNA there, but there's very low miR-223. So all I can tell you is that miR-223 doesn't stimulate luciferase, but God knows as I said, later on when in collaboration with Alan Lambowitz, we've done a complete RNA sequence analysis on all the species in these exosomes, and the overwhelming signal is of transfer RNA, fairly non-selective packaging of transfer RNAs into these, and surely, the cytosol has lots of transfer RNA. Why transfer RNAs incorporated, we have no idea. But that's, anyway, so, okay. Now, so cytosol is required, not surprisingly. One imagines that since there's a sequence, a selective packaging of miR-223, that maybe there's an RNA binding protein that's involved in this. And so what Matt did was a variation on the reaction that you've already heard about, and he used, in place of miR-223 RNA, he used a biotinylated form of synthetic miR-223, incorporated that during the packaging event, removed all the other non-incorporated RNA, and collected what was enclosed within the vesicles formed in vitro, and bound it to streptavidin beads to collect any miR-223 and whatever proteins were bound to it, and eluted the proteins from these beads and did a mass spec analysis. There were several RNA binding proteins, abundant RNA binding proteins, but the one that really stood out, most abundant in terms of its representation in peptides from this mass spec analysis, was a protein called the YBX1 protein, which is already known to be secreted from cells within extracellular vesicles. So here's a paper that was published several years ago describing this protein. It was actually, the protein was already well known, YBX1, and these investigators found it in extracellular membranes, apparently, because the protein was itself resistant to trypsin unless the material is treated with detergent. That's a, you know, simple criterion for it being within an extracellular vesicle. And they claimed it might be some kind of a mitogen, although I don't think the evidence was particularly strong for that. Okay, so fortunately there's a good polyclonal monospecific antibody against the YBX1 protein. And so Matt did the following experiment to examine the packaging of that protein from the crude extract, the crude cytosol, into vesicles that form in this cell-free reaction. He did the following. He conducted the incubation with biotinylated miR-223. Then after the reaction, after the RNase digestion, the membranes are dissolved. Streptavidin beads were used to fish out biotinylated miR-223. And then the coincident packaging of the YBX1 protein was evaluated by immunoblot. And so in a full incubation with membranes and cytosol, and where the reaction was processed with ribonuclease before the addition of detergent, sure enough, there's the YBX1 protein that can be detected in this streptavidin IP. Its presence is dependent upon having conducted the incubation with crude cytosol. Detection was dependent upon having membranes present. So it's not just miR-223 binding YBX1 protein and happening to resist ribonuclease. There's some active involvement of membranes. The reaction is temperature stimulated and greatly reduced if the miR-223 is not included in the incubation. Okay, so it's there. Probably comes from the cytosol. It binds miR-223. It becomes incorporated. But what does this say about what that protein actually does to promote this sorting event? Is it actively required for RNA sorting? That's the important functional question. And to address this, we've deleted or rendered null both copies of the YBX1 gene. Using CRISPR-Cas9, we generated alleles. Eventually a homozygous null allele. Turns out it's a frame shift mutation, but this the protein product of YBX1 is ablated in this null allele. The cells that are deficient in YBX1 grow normally. There's no obvious defect that we've found, at least in the overall health of the HEK293 cells. But as you'll see, there are two paralogs of YBX1, one of which is upregulated when YBX1 null is rendered inactivated. So our first experiment was to ask if cytosol taken from this cell is active or not in first the biogenesis assay, the one where we measure the formation of latent luciferase, and is this cytosol active or not in the packaging of miR-223. And that result, which was fairly clear-cut, is shown on the next slide. So on the left is the biogenesis assay, where we measure the formation of latent luciferase. And just focus on these two lanes. Wild-type cytosol, YBX1 null cytosol were equally proficient in forming, measuring luciferase activity in the biogenesis assay. The controls were reduced, although not so persuasively here, but they're lower. There's really no obvious difference between mutant and wild type, at least in that reaction. However, importantly, in the microRNA packaging reaction, this lane is the relevant one. This is an incubation with YBX1 null cytosol, where the packaging of miR-223 was reduced fivefold compared to two controls, and compared maybe threefold compared to a YBX1 null cell into which a fresh copy of the YBX1 gene was introduced by stable transfection. So this suggested, at least in the biochemical reaction, that miR-223 sorting is dependent on the YBX1 gene and protein. Now, a more stringent test is to ask whether exosomes produced by HEK293 cells depend upon the YBX1 gene in intact cells. And here, where there's a small complication that did not play out for some reason in the biochemical assay, when we looked at these cells compared to wild type, we noticed that the second copy of YBX, the YBX2 gene, which is normally completely dormant in HEK293 cells, is quite substantially upregulated, at least at the level of the messenger RNA, in the YBX1 null, whereas the third copy is more or less dormant in both circumstances. And the null, the YBX1 null, attempts to compensate for the mutation by making more of its own non-functional messenger RNA. So this was a complication. It didn't seem to interfere with the biochemical reaction, but it did, as you'll see, slightly complicate the picture from with intact cells. In this experiment, Matt isolated exosomes from wild-type cells, from YBX1 null cells, or from YBX1 null cells in which the YBX2 gene was ablated by siRNA. And you'll note that in the YBX1 single null, the reduction in the exosome production was normal, but their content of miR-223 was reduced maybe only by 1/3. However, if the YBX2 gene was rendered null by siRNA in the YBX1 null cell, there was a substantial further reduction in the efficiency of packaging of miR-223 compared to exosomes, which were still produced normally by this cell. So this says there may be, in the context of a cell, there may be some compensation by the YBX2 protein to overcome the deficit, and for reasons that I can't explain, that deficit was not so apparent in the in vitro reaction. Yes, Wallace.
How does the reduction in packaging in the double knockdown compare to the selectivity for non-specific?
Yeah, that's a good comparison. But we've done a deep-seq RNA analysis on this guy with just knocking out the single YBX1 null. And almost all of the RNAs that are packaged, even transfer RNAs, are reduced fivefold. So it's even more dramatic a requirement for YBX1 in the packaging of transfer RNAs than of miR-223. So there are other RNAs that are not affected at all, though, by the YBX1 null. So it's a major RNA binding protein with some role in packaging RNA. Yes?
Sorry, maybe I'm misremembering. Is this one the one that was 1,000-fold?
Yeah.
Well, okay, and we're only seeing fivefold reduction by knocking this out.
Yeah.
Maybe
there's some, maybe. So here's what we're doing to address that, the maybe. There's another RNA. There are other RNAs that are seemingly not affected by the YBX1 null. So we're going to go back and repeat the streptavidin pull-down experiment with those RNAs and see if there's something else that pops up. I mentioned briefly that there's another vesicle that we found that has a different buoyant density whose membrane composition is different. We're purifying those vesicles. We're just now subjecting those to a deep-seq RNA analysis to see what other RNAs may be there. And you can imagine we can do this ad nauseum over and over to see what different kinds of biochemical requirements we may be able to tease out. So, a lot to do. There was a question over here.
YBX3 upregulating the
double? We didn't look at that. Yeah. I caution when I give this presentation lately, everything that I've talked about is one graduate student so far, so please bear with us. Yes?
Along the lines of comparing the exosomal fraction and the cytosolic distribution, if you just sort of compare the abundance of RNA in one fraction versus the other, does one see any systematic dependence on length of RNA?
Well, the RNAs in exosomes are decidedly smaller than the average lengths of RNAs in the cytoplasm of cells. There are some longer species. There are even some reports of intact messenger RNAs in exosomes. But if you just look at the bulk distribution of RNAs, they focus on around 100 nucleotides. And as I said, the by far the most abundant species is full-length transfer RNAs. But in the case of the transfer RNAs, there isn't this kind of selectivity that we see with the microRNAs. There, you know, all, we can see, you know, sort of all transfer RNAs. So it's really. Did you have a question? Because So I have some more experiments. 5 more minutes. Okay. There's some really cool experiments I want to go to. So let's do it and then see what you. I'm sure you have more questions. So Matt. So then the next question is there some sequence in miR-223, or those that are enriched, that is kind of a signal for sorting? And so Nick Ingoli, a new faculty member in the department, suggested to Matt that they do a version of a Celex in vitro selection using our in vitro system to sort from a huge random pool of 25 mers for sequences that may be preferred in the sorting event, irrespective of any particular RNA binding protein. So here's the outline of that Celex. He calls it exo-Celex, for exosome Celex. Basically, it's the same reaction that you've already heard. Cytosol, membranes, miR-223, ATP. The packaging is conducted. The sample is subjected to ribonuclease. The species that are preserved are, and he starts with a pool of oligos of some enormous complexity. These sequences that are preserved are amplified, recloned, new RNAs made in the process, repeated 1, 2, 3, and 4 times, each time looking at the complexity of the full set of sequences that emerge that are protected at each stage. And in the course of the incubation, there are changes. Some sequences, when we developed an algorithm to explore 8 mer sequences within these within the populations. There are some that are enriched over the course of the exo-Celex, and there are some sequences that are depleted. If after 4 cycles you explore the quite enormous set of molecules that persist, and look for common sequence elements in 2 repetitions of the exo-Celex experiment, the sequences that emerge are enriched in tracks of C. In the first replicate, 3 C's. In the second replicate, even 4 C's. And if you then explore the sequences within the microRNAs that are enriched in exosomes, as miR-223, wow, it's perfect. We couldn't have asked for anything better. It's got a tetra-C. Whereas miR-190, which is not enriched, I told you, is devoid of these tracks of C. So now, Matt then did a test to see whether this sequence really is important for packaging miR-223. Really simple experiment that people who study protein sorting always use. It's test of whether the sequence is necessary and sufficient for sorting. The necessity experiment was simply to mutate the C track in miR-223 to make a mutant and to ask whether this mutant is active or not in packaging in vitro. The alternative was to introduce a C track near the 3' end of miR-190 to ask whether it could now become proficient in packaging. And obviously, I'm telling you this because it worked. Here's the result. miR-223 packaging, you used a different metric to measure it in this kind of experiment, but was very, very efficient as before. Whereas the mutant lacking the C tract is no longer active in packaging. miR-190 was reduced by itself, but became much more active in packaging when a mutant was created with a C tract introduced near the 3' end. So, these are new experiments. There are, you know, more questions than we can even think of. It reminds me of a time many years ago when we first developed the cell-free system to measure the traffic of proteins with isolated membranes. And at the time, I used a Gary Larson cartoon to describe our relative ignorance, showing, you know, early experiments in transport here with a rotation student strapped to the wheel, a victim of our work. Mm-hmm. So we're looking for more victims now. Let me conclude with, again, the model. We imagine that miR-223, indeed many other RNAs, bind in the cytoplasm to this YBX1 protein. The ribonucleoprotein particle is complex, is then registered by some, we imagine, some element of the escort machinery required for the production of invaginations to produce intraluminal vesicles. We have we have evidence for a sorting signal on miR-223, this C track. We want to know how that's captured by whatever other machinery in the cytosol or on the membrane. And finally, going back to the question that I posed a few minutes ago, I've assumed, just for the sake of cartoons, that this process works on an endosome, but I admitted the possibility that it could all be working at the cell surface. And what's nice about, again, this kind of in vitro system is we can answer that question. Presumably, the starting material in our in vitro system will have pieces of plasma membrane and endosomes. We know from our experience in the lab that these two membranes can be resolved on buoyant densities, buoyant density gradients. So one experiment that we haven't yet done would be to take the crude membranes that participate in this reaction, resolve these membranes, and ask whether it's the activity tracks with the endosomal fraction or with the plasma membrane fraction. It's an experiment that's dying to be done, and we'll address this overall biogenesis process. So let me finish by pointing out the people who've done the work that I described this morning. The work on collagen secretion was done by Kanika Bajaj, who was a postdoc in the lab. She's now a staff scientist at Genentech. It's continued by Amita Gorur, a graduate student in the lab, Lin Yuan, another graduate student in the lab, and a former Japanese fellow, Satoshi Baba, who's now back in Japan. And all the work that I've described on exosomes and microRNAs was done by this wonderful graduate student, Matt Shurtleff. Thanks.
Okay, Boris, you're the one and only.
Yeah, so tRNAs terminate in a CCA. Whether that CCA is actually required for packaging, we haven't tested yet. Yeah, too good to be true. That, you know, that's an obvious experiment that we can do. So, and we will. But again, so let me speculate a little here, because there's another very interesting field that I've become aware of that may intersect with this, and that is this question of RNA granules in the cytoplasm. And so one really interesting possibility is that this pathway, for whatever reason, is swallowing up RNA granules and spitting them out of the cell. And there's one little piece of evidence that is too good to be true. So these RNA granules are organized in part by proteins that have sequences called low complexity sequences. Steve McKnight has promoted this view that these RNA binding proteins with low complexity sequences form a separate phase that can be recapitulated in vitro. And guess what? YBX1 protein has such a low complexity sequence and has already been proposed by others to be engaged in RNA granules within the cytoplasm. So it could be that the RNAs that are being taken up are part of a granule that's being swallowed up, you know, within the endosome. Yes.
I wonder if there are ways that if RNAs have to escape this mechanism, for example, messenger RNAs, have you been able to see if this sequence is absent or depleted in
It's unimaginable that it's depleted from messenger RNAs because it's not such a complex sequence. Yeah. So how other RNAs avoid being captured? Maybe they're not part of an RNA granule.
Is it for sure that it's not?
Yeah, we've done a very thorough analysis, and you know, messenger RNAs just aren't so obvious in these. Also, it's a question of physical capacity. These things are, you know, the luminal content of these vesicles is pretty small. So, but anyway, the beauty of this approach, which is why we always go to this approach, is, you know, we can reproduce this in vitro, and so it should be accessible to biochemical fractionation, which is where we're headed.
I just wanted to make sure there's time for the students to interact with him. So actually, students, why don't you guys just stay here, and you guys will talk to Randy in this room, and everyone else, we need to clear out of here. Thanks so much.
That's the nature impact factor.
That's really awesome.
That was last night. You missed last night. The evil impact factor. That's a different sermon that I give.
I might just, should I wait for you?
Okay, that's fine.
See you, Randy.
Escort procedures.
What?
Escort procedures.
What about them?
Because they're involved in.
Yeah, right. Well, we our results are equivocal on that point. We've made a dominant mutant VPS4,
right.
No effect on the in vitro reaction. We've made a partial effect. We made a dominant mutant escort2 protein with virtually no effect. So, in fact, others have done these sorts of experiments with intact cells with equivocal results about whether escorts are required or not. And
for hedgehog secretion, for sure, you need these escorts.
You do.
Sort of escorts, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, I'm not
different recipe.
Maybe, but I'm not confident that our experiments answer that question yet. But there it is. It happens in vitro, so it should, you know, we should be able to resolve the cytosolic proteins, and if the escorts are required, they'll come out in the fractionation.
Okay, Randy, so I'm going to get hold of you one of these days.
I'll come. I promise. Okay, good to see you. Good to see you, and I'll see you next April.
Okay.
In Washington.
All right, so I'll come by here.
Should I not have closed up here? Maybe they have questions about.
I don't know.
All right, well, I won't close up completely.
I'll come by at 5 of.
All right.
And we'll zip over to the restaurant.
Okay.
They'll all be waiting for us.
Very good. I'll drive my car along with you from there.
Okay.
All right, would you just walk over to the restaurant from here?
We should drive. I'll drive you, actually. It's literally 5 minutes, but since we're on tight schedule to get the reservation.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Questions? Yes.
I would actually like to hear your opinions about scientific publishing.
Oh, okay.
All
right. So you didn't come to hear my sermon last night. All right. Yeah.
I did not.
Okay,
so
fine.
Maybe it's redundant for some people, but
yeah.
In particular, both what you think. Well, maybe both your concerns about the present situation and where you think it should go, but also what, say, young people should be doing to try to affect.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so I spend most of my life dealing with this issue because I'm the editor of an open access journal, eLife. And I was the editor-in-chief of the PNAS for 5 years, and I saw with increasing disgust the stranglehold that the largely commercial, very selective journals, Cell, Nature, and Science, had on the imagination of people of your generation. Now, you know, I published in these journals myself over the years, but I would say it's really only in the last 15 years that the problem has gotten much worse, where people feel, at all stages in their career, feel that if they don't publish in Cell, Nature, or Science, they're not going to have a career. They're not going to get a fellowship. They're not going to get a job. And you know, when and why did this happen? And how did we allow the decisions about our fate to be managed by people, professional editors, who are no longer active scientists and whose, frankly, judgment we would not normally seek? I mean, think about this. When you send your work to Nature or Cell, who's making the decision? The initial decision is made by a professional editor who maybe used to work in a lab sometimes many years ago, may not be intimately familiar. And then in the end, of course, they consult scientists as referees if they decide that the papers are interesting. But in the end, the final decision is made by those professional editors. So what dictates their decision? Although they deny this, the evidence is indisputable that they are looking to optimize the visibility of their journal, to sell magazines, based often by this stupid number called the impact factor, which you all know of, which many know to three significant figures. I mean, it's amazing that this number is promulgated with the appearance of precision when the data on which it's based is ridiculous. So these journals, though they will insist that it's not true, base their decisions on what to publish, on whether the paper, they think the paper is going to generate a lot of interest in the form of citations. So this distorts not only what you choose to do for your scholarship, but it distorts the message that you use to frame your paper. And I think it's an enormously distorting influence, not only changing the kind of work that we do, but it influences some people in a kind of a pathological way, to cut corners, to misrepresent their work, or to commit fraud. And there are many examples. Indeed, it's curious but true that there is a correlation between the impact factor of a journal and the number of retractions that journal has to issue. So I think this has been a toxic influence, and many of us feel that it's time to do something about it. And so, you know, I've taken it on as a personal crusade. I admit I'm sort of immune to this myself, but I feel from my position that it's important to try to do something to create a journal that competes at that level, but where the decisions are not based on whether the paper is going to generate a lot of citations, but based on an active scientist measure, evaluation of the scholarly impact of the work. So at eLife, papers come in, they're evaluated, we have a professional staff, but they don't make any scientific decisions. All the decisions are made by active, prominent scientists from around the world. And we will not, I mean, these journals also, the commercial journals, deliberately restrict the number of papers and pages that they publish to create this sense of exclusivity that people feed off of. It creates a feeding frenzy. So every journal of that genre has as a policy to accept fewer than 10% of the submissions, because they have understand your psyche, and you think people created the impression that you can only survive if you're measured as being one of the chosen few. And I think this is really toxic. It was never true when I was growing up in science, and I think we need to wrest control away from these people. And that's what we're trying to do at eLife. So now you, as victims of this system, often tell me, it's all well and good that you say this, but I still need to get a job. I still need to get a fellowship. What am I to do? How can I avoid that rat race? And I can tell you that there are people who've resisted this all along and who still manage to have good careers. My postdocs know that their highest aspiration will be to publish in eLife, not in Cell Nature and Science, and they've done well. They've gotten jobs. They've gotten fellowships. So it's a myth, really, that is fostered by these commercial journals that, if you don't publish there, you're screwed. It's time to change that myth, and that's what I'm trying to do. So that's the sermon.
It's like dining cartels.
Yeah.
You have to buy them.
That's a great analogy. That's a great analogy. I'm trying to create artificial diamonds. Yes. Yeah. Yes. In fact, all of our one way I measure success of the journal is that I've asked the members of my editorial board to send us their best papers, and we have a group of senior editors who are very active in the journal, and many of them, maybe even most of them, have had papers rejected by eLife. I mean, absolutely. If we didn't reject our own papers, we wouldn't be fair. I was when I was editor-in-chief of the PNAS, it's a fine journal run by active scientists, but there, members of the National, you may not know this, but members who are of the National Academy have special privileges of publishing in the PNAS that allow them to escape anonymous peer review for their own work. And that taints the journal. And that'll never go away because the members will never give up that privilege. So with eLife, although it's funded by Howard Hughes, by the Wellcome Trust and Max Planck, I absolutely insisted that those people funded by those organizations would have no special privileges, absolutely none. Their papers are scrutinized just as others are. So.
Can I ask what's the next step forward? Because, for example, you started like recently, and you're right now, it's a very tough. I mean, the research that I've seen there is pretty amazing, but you still have to be very selective. Is there a next plan? Okay, maybe we'll do more specific journals?
No. Yeah, we've talked about that, whether we would ourselves create clones of eLife. And our feeling is no. Why do that? The commercial journals do that for business reasons. There's no reason. I don't think there's a reason to do that in this, with a journal that's online. If you only want to look at, the papers, the biochemistry papers, there's a link that you can click that will select only the biochemistry papers that are published. So our intention is to ramp up, and we are, the submissions are just, going through the roof. We're gonna publish all the really good papers that we review, and we're just gonna grow. And we feel that we can scale. So far we're adding more members of the editorial board. We'll scale. We want to have influence. We want to change the way that scholarship is evaluated. So we have a special way of reviewing papers. I can tell you one of the most unique thing about eLife is that when a paper comes in and it's judged by one of our senior editors to be appropriate and interesting, it's then given over to one of a very large number of members of the board of reviewing editors. Boris actually is a member of our large board of reviewing editors. And they then are asked to identify two other experts to referee the paper. And just as in any journal, the referees review the work independently. But then the critiques are collected and posted online at the manuscript website for each other to read, not the author, but the referees and the board member then are asked over a period of a day or more to read each other's critiques. They are unblinded to one another, so their identity is known. And they are then in an online chat room, they talk back and forth about the relative merits or deficiencies of a paper. And if a paper is judged sufficiently compelling to encourage for publication, the board member is asked to just identify the key things that need to be addressed, and that author then receives a single decision letter written by the board member in consultation with the referees that the author then can respond to. And we then ask the board member after the author responds to make a unilateral decision without necessarily going back to the referees to sort of skips this endless back and forth that you often have with a paper nature cell. Yes?
Just a follow-up question. So at the stage when the referees can read each other's letters, does everyone, can I read the first letter that's submitted, or do you wait until everybody submitted and only then they can read it? Really?
Yeah. We the board member can see the other letters as they come in, but the other referees, the ad hoc referees, don't see the critiques until after they've been posted. So you don't even know, the other referee doesn't necessarily know who, the referee will know who the board member is who commissioned the review, but they won't know who the other ad hoc referee is until the reviews are posted. But going into the process that you will eventually, your identity will be revealed to the other people. And so I think I like that because it kind of enforces some civility. In other review processes like at Cell, you don't know who the other reviewers are. Generally you don't even get to comment on their reviews. And sometimes people are, really nasty in a way, I think, and sometimes it's fostered by this being able to hide behind your anonymity. But if you have to speak openly with your peers, I think maybe you'll be a little more circumspect. And so we've seen that, and we've seen these conversations. I mean, sometimes there are disagreements, but you know, usually they come to some resolution. Yes? We have papers that we're retracting, absolutely. We feel very strongly that if we make a mistake in the editorial process, or the author has made a mistake, that it be highlighted and published. And the way we've published the challenges to our papers is twofold. One is in the online version of the paper, the HTML version of the paper, there's an opportunity for comments to be posted. They cannot be posted anonymously. They have to be identified. So people can write in and say, you know, here's the flaw. It doesn't happen too often. In two other instances, we've had submissions from people who challenged eLife papers, and we published them. After review, we published them as short reports that are linked to the original paper, and the author of the original paper is then given an opportunity to respond. In one instance, there was a major correction issued from a paper. And just today and yesterday, I'm dealing with another one that almost certainly will head in that direction. But our feeling, if you were there last night, I said that one of the problems with the commercial journals is they are very reluctant to retract papers. But our feeling is retraction is part of the process, or correction is part of the process. And we can't hide mistakes. They're made, and they need to be honestly faced. And since we're an online journal, there, you know, we don't have a limited number of pages that we can publish. We'll publish, you know, we'll just, you know, it's online, so it doesn't cost that much more. Yes?
I know another discussion where someone tries to use it, and at the end there's somewhere assigned wrong, and it takes a long time. So since yours is an online journal, is it possible to correct such minor mistakes?
Yeah, well, in any journal online, I mean, all journals have an online presence, and you can issue corrections, and the correction will be posted as part of the paper. I mean, the original, I don't know, I don't think you change the original, an original figure, but you post a correction that is linked to the paper so that any online reader can see this.
Why not change it?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I think for the sake of the record, probably the original version should be preserved. I mean, even when a paper is retracted, I think it's still there. I don't think it's removed from the online record, but it can have a you know, an electronic watermark on it that indicates, you know, retracted. So it's kind of a, you know, black mark. But I think you have to do it. Yes?
So now that this whole celebration is on stage, is out of the way, what other attributes of an ideal faculty candidate would you look for besides that?
Uh-huh, sure. I'll just give you my personal perspective. I know that my views are different than other colleagues, but when I'm evaluating prospective, you know, junior faculty, let's say, who are postdocs, what I'm looking for is, you know, what they published, you know, important. I look for important work. But I also look for original ideas. So I'm really not so excited to get a postdoc as a faculty member who's just been very productive as a postdoc and continue and who proposes to continue doing the same thing. Now, I know the system is very conservative, and postdocs feel that if they're, you know, that they're on a productive line, they have to continue if they're going to get NIH funding. But the system was always conservative. It's not just recently. And my feeling is, if you're at the outset of an independent career, if you're not going to do something original at that moment in your life, you're never going to do anything original. So I feel very strongly that I'm looking for postdocs who are proposing to do something bold and new, and not just to continue to turn the crank. And others have a different perspective, but I can tell you in my career that's exactly what I did. Maybe it's self-serving to say this, but I don't regret the choices that I made, even though my first NIH grant was trashed as a result of not having preliminary data.
And that's even if those novel ideas don't have
Yeah, I mean, how can they? I mean, I think I look at the people who've been my peers who've been most successful. They've been willing to be daring and do something that others haven't done. So my first NIH grant was to work on yeast. I'd never worked on yeast before. My postdoc was not on yeast. I'd never done genetics before. I was crazy, but I wanted to do this. I thought it was worthwhile. I'd been successful. I knew how to pipette. But the NIH took a dim view. My first grant was trashed because I had no relevant experience. I had no preliminary data. I did get an NSF grant, and we made some progress. We isolated some interesting mutants, and I went back to the NIH and said, "Oh, this is wonderful. Let's fund you." So that's one piece of advice. Now, another piece of advice, which my colleague Jim Rothman cited, and I think it's a really good one, is if you want to hit a home run, you have to be in the ballpark. What that means is you have to think of something that's doable. You know, it's one thing to dream about, you know, solving the brain. It's another thing to actually circumscribe a problem that is feasible to approach with existing technology or with technology that can be created for that purpose. So I think it's really important to think practically about, you know, a problem that is tractable. And some are just, you know, it's hard to define, but it's, you know, when I hear about a project that is, I mean, like this exosome thing that I described when this graduate student joined my lab, it immediately became obvious to me that this was an attractive area, even though it was very messy and the field was really very low standards. It was just intrinsically obvious how one could approach it using the logic of a biochemist. And so it didn't discourage me at all that the literature was lousy. That's the kind of problem I look for. Yes?
I'm wondering what you think about whether selectivity is, or what you think about selectivity, do you like, I mean, in general, whether mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or even something that's like archive.
That may be the future. That may be the future. Indeed, most of you don't even look at journals at all. You have some Google Scholar or whatever. You look up a subject and you go to PubMed and you just find the papers on that particular subject. And that may be the future of a scientific publication. If it evolves that way, fine. That's fine. But for the time being, most people still rely on the imprimatur of a set of scholars whom you would in principle respect, whose judgment is that this is something really new and interesting. And that is the nature of a journal serving to as an arbiter, if you will, of what's important. And so the question is, who do you trust? Do you trust a group of active scientists who's been successful and whose judgment you would seek out in other circumstances, or do you trust a commercial outfit that's looking to sell you magazines? That really, to me, is the decision now, but maybe eventually that won't be. Now, PLOS One, the idea for PLOS One is great, and the hope was that by providing a forum for discussion at the end of a paper, that there would be, in a way, a kind of a post-publication review process. But you know what? That hasn't worked. Who has the time? If you look at the PLOS One paper, very few of them generate any comments at the end. Who has the time? Maybe the physics archive has worked very well in physics. Maybe the bioarchive will work for biology. I think it's worth a worthwhile experiment. We'll see. But I think for the time being, there's still, it's unfortunate to have to use this term, but there is a kind of a branding that happens which is the nature of selection by a journal.
So you view that as a necessary evil, perhaps just a transitory?
I think it is transitory. I really, I don't know how many more years I'll have in this business, but I think probably I'll it's not going to go away during my active lifetime, but it could in the future go away, and that would be fine. I don't care. Especially, I don't care if it does away with this commercial aspect or this what I call luxury journal aspect of these selective journals. Well, Well, it's a lot of different things. I'm looking for something original, as I said. Fair enough. So people say, all right, you're not going to look at Cell Nature Science. You're not going to look at Impact Factor. What are you going to look at when you're faced with 300 applications from people from all over the world? What some departments are doing, and this I think is a good development, is that each candidate is asked to express succinctly, in let's say a paragraph, the most important work they've done. In a way that could be understood by a literate life science professional, audience, of scholars. And I think you could go through 300 applications and read a little sort of impact statement, you might call it. One paragraph, one very formal. Now, let me give you an example. It's admittedly not applicable to postdocs, but it works. When people are nominated for election to the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, there's a very stylized nomination statement that is crafted that has this, an abbreviated CV. And the list of the 12 most important publications of that person in their career. But the most important thing for the nomination statement is two impact statements, one 50 words and the other 250 words. And that I can read, and I can decide whether a person who's an entomologist has made something that sounds interesting. Whereas I'm not going to read their papers. When I get a book with candidates from all of the sciences, I try to read those impact statements. And so I think even at an early stage in your career, you could craft such an impact statement. Now, another example where it works is when people who are funded by Howard Hughes, as investigators, every 5 years you have to come up for renewal. You write a report. It's very much more abbreviated than an NIH grant. But what they do is they ask you to identify the 5 most important papers during the preceding 5 years. And you have to list everything that you publish. But the people who evaluate Hughes investigators for renewal look at those 5 papers, and you write an impact statement about each paper so that in one paragraph the reviewer can get a snapshot, and then they can read the paper. So they're not just counting Cell Nature and Science papers, I can assure you. And then they have really good people who are doing the reviewing. So I think there's a way to do it. But unfortunately, what's happened, because we're all so busy, is that people use the name of a journal as a surrogate measurement of quality. And when you dissect that, you find out how flawed it is. So when you're sitting around a room and you've got a bunch of candidates and somebody says, well, he published this in Nature, big deal. I mean, guess what? It could be wrong. More often than not, it is. I think we need to get away from that and have some way of actually, understanding what's in the paper rather than where it was published. But it's ingrained in our behavior, and it's a struggle to change people's attitudes about that. And so that's what I've been trying to do.
And related to this question and my previous question, how reproducible is this scheme of life? And so, I love the whole thing, the way you explain the review takes place. Mm-hmm. But I'm pretty sure the people that are involved in that, it takes like a lot of time from them.
It's work.
So how much reproducible do you think it can it be done again? And basically my idea is kind of like if there's good research that for X or Y reason, kind of go and elect, you have other journals that do the same editing.
Yeah.
So that the public things that are published there will be able to take advantage of this whole scheme and get just better research in general.
So the style of review that we've developed at eLife is portable, I think. Other journals could do this. In fact, other journals are starting to do it. Journal of Neuro, there's an electronic journal from the Society of Neuroscience that's doing exactly the way we do it. And other journals are talking about doing this. It's not a big deal. I mean, it is more work, admittedly, because you have to. There's a period after the review is done where the editor has to have some conversation with the referees. But a lot of referees actually, it's amazing actually how they enjoy it, because they feel some sense of ownership in the decision that they didn't have before. Typically in the past, you'd send in your review and, you know, it was some editor's responsibility, and whether that was a professional editor or a scientific editor, and then you didn't see what happened until the decision was rendered. So so the board member actually, the person whose responsibility is to make the decision, I think finds some benefit in being able to confer with the referees more actively. And the referees feel like they have some participation beyond what they did before. So in fact, part of our success at eLife is that we've developed this kind of spreading community of people who participate in the various ways in our review process. And many of them quite enjoy it, and then they're encouraged to send papers because they like the way we handle papers. So I think it works. And I think any journal where active scholars make the decisions could do this. The journals where I think they aren't going to do it is the ones that are run by professional editors. Because imagine these people trying to supervise a conversation with other active scientists and engage on an equal footing with these people. They can't do it. And by doing so, they implicitly lose control of the process too. And that's why I don't think you're going to see them adopt this. Unless they start to lose market share, then they may be forced to. Okay, we really didn't talk science at all here, did we? Yes.
Yeah, since you just said that, I still have a science question.
Good.
I was wondering about your in-vitro essay,
yeah.
The membranes and the RNA.
Yeah.
So in your early picture about how a cell works, you have this the endosomes take up.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And then they go to the interface and then they exclude them.
Yeah.
Would you expect to see also this extrusion in the in vitro thing?
Extrusion, where the end is, where the multivesicular body fuses with the plasma membrane. Yeah, that could be happening in our in vitro system, but the readout would be insensitive to that event, because the vesicle, if the MVB happened to fuse with a fragment of plasma membrane in our in vitro reaction, what would be expelled from the reaction are little vesicles, which would have the RNA inside or have the luciferase inside. And so the measurement that we have would see the same thing. So that reaction could not be isolated for study by the reaction that we've devised. You would have to have some other way of measuring that event. Uh-huh. Well, I'm not sure how that would work. But if you wanted to study what you've asked for, the last step where this thing is, the structure fuses with the plasma membrane and expels, you could set up something like what we do to measure the production of COP2 vesicles, which is just a differential centrifugation. So the prediction of that last event would be you'd start with a membrane that sedimented rapidly because it was a big balloon full of vesicles. But when it fuses with the plasma membrane, it would release small vesicles that didn't sediment at low speed. So you would look for the formation of luciferase in slowly sedimenting vesicles. That might be a measurement of the last step. We haven't tried that, but that might work. So the final point, and this maybe is maybe not so, you won't see this too often, is that it is my conviction that anything that happens inside of a cell can be reproduced in vitro in a cell-free reaction. And I think, from my experience, that that's really the way that you can get to understanding the mechanism of complex processes to me, a satisfying way. And it is unfortunate, I find, among my colleagues, in general, among cell biologists, that they're very reluctant to do that kind of biochemical manipulation, because they'd rather make GFP this and that and study things at high resolution in intact cells where you can learn a lot, but I don't think you can learn the fundamental chemical processes as readily. So that's another one of my sermons.
I guess the last question was, are exosomes that are carrying the BRT23, are they more effective at downregulating these targets?
Yeah, that's a great question that we would love to address but haven't started to. Yeah, that's the obvious next step, is to be able to track the uptake, the fusion of these exosomes with a target cell, and to measure the effect of miR-223 on a target gene in those cells. And we haven't done that, but we have some ideas about how to proceed, and I just need more bodies to do that.
Cool. Thank you very much.